Hello and welcome to edition 369 of the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Robert Band, and Marcus Hippie.
On today's show, we'll be discussing New Zealand and how it makes its wildlife a cultural asset with Sir Lockwood Smith, High Commissioner of New Zealand to the United Kingdom.
We'll also be looking closer to home at London and asking, how do you present the city in new and ever more playful ways? Henry Elliott, co-author of Curiosity, an unorthodox guide to London, will be speaking to us later.
And we'll also be talking to Turner Prize-winning artist Martin Creed. He's also a music maker and he'll be discussing his new record, Thoughts Lined Up, at the end of the show.
That's all coming up, plus Monocle's Henry Rees-Sheridan will be lining up thoughts on next week's news too. We'll play some records too, of course. You know the form, it's the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. And there we have it. I almost said Andrew there.
Did you say Andrew almost?
I almost said Andrew.
We look similar.
It's just you've come in a full three-piece tweed hunting suit, which is what Andrew normally wears.
British made.
Yeah, of course. That's how he likes to roll on a Sunday. Then he sort of drives into the countryside and goes and sort of hunts something and eats it. I know he's a vegetarian. I'm just winding him up.
But it's really funny that you say that, because that's exactly what I've been thinking about recently, about hunting and eating things you get from nature. I've been kind of recovering from my trip to Stavanger, Norway. You may have noticed I was away there.
I did notice you, and I missed you greatly. Now, let's talk about this, because you know that there are lots of food groups within the Monocle listening audience, and so some people that listen to the Monocle Weekly will know your voice sometimes from Monocle Weekly, but they won't know you from all of the different things that you do here. So you're the presenter of the food show, the menu on Monocle 24. So you went to Stavanger in Norway.
I know you don't like cold places, so I don't know if you've been in Norway.
I love going skiing, but I have no interest in going to cold places just for the sake of it. It seems like a waste.
I know. Anyway, the sun was shining in Stavanger. People were happy and beautiful and athletic, and it's a weird bubble.
All right, so Marcus Hippie pulled.
No, I didn't.
I thought it was a food conference.
No, I was busy doing interviews and reporting on food culture, how it's changing. It's changing phase, the future
no
of industry.
No one would go to do that. Come on, tell us what you really
did. I actually even gave a speech about that. Anyway, people are happy, very huggy, smiling all the time.
Yeah.
So much kissing, cheek kissing and all
really?
That. Yeah, there was no personal space there.
Really?
I was very surprised
by
that.
Are you the kind of person that needs a certain amount of personal space
in order
to get through the
general
day?
I always think that I'm slightly, you know, I don't like too much of that kind of intimacy, but they're big on that in Norway.
Are they really?
Yeah, and I was really surprised. Maybe it was those food people I met over there. Maybe it was just Stavanger,
food festival. Yeah, I mean, you think of a food festival, there's a lot of drink flowing around. Were people well refreshed? Was it a little, did you get a huffy bit of wine breath and a peck or two on the cheek, Marcus?
To be honest, every now and then, yes, I was extremely well fed, and I there was no lack of wine either.
I don't know why that made that sound dirty, but it wasn't. It was
I don't know why. In a way, that kind of like the way I describe it reminds me of your recent trip to the Mediterranean to spend on a cruise ship a few days.
Oh,
I can imagine
there was a good offering.
Like
it was a bit like that
there as well. Yeah,
there was a bit of bonhomie.
What have you been up to, by the way?
Well, this week we've been closing our September issue of the magazine, so it's been our noses have been fairly adjacent to grindstones all week, and so it's been fine. There's been a lot of pages to sign off, a lot of things to be written, a lot of red pen. Back from teacher.
When you
hand in your essay.
Exactly. I know the feeling. Anything you're particularly excited by?
Absolutely nothing.
Okay. Just asking.
Only joking. I love it. What should we do next, I wonder, other than look forward with the most bated of breath to the September issue of Monocle magazine? I can't wait for next week's news. Who's going to furnish us with it? Only one man, Henry Rees-Sheridan.
Hi, guys.
Hi, Henry.
How are you doing today?
Very well, Marcus. It's nice to have you in. Thanks for replacing Andrew this week. Normally, he's insulted my intelligence by this stage. You've just managed to blame undue intimacy on food people in Stavanger. So it's a nice change.
Stavanger.
Stavanger.
Stavanger. I love that.
It's like Stavanger.
Stavanger could be the brand name of a sort of sheep dip that was featured in The Archers. Oi, you got any of that Stavanger in there?
I thought Stavanger could be a kind of fusion entertainment project between the directors of a Nordic noir thriller and Midsommar Murders.
Henry, basing on what you've been looking at, what's happening in the news front, how do you predict what is the next, what is next week going to be like in Stavanger?
In Marcus, it would be
miserable.
Very. I would wager that on the 5th of August, Marcus, more than a few of them might be tuning in to the opening ceremony of the 2016 Olympic Games in Rio de Janeiro in Brazil. There's going to be the opening ceremony of probably one of the biggest logistical pains in the arse in recent years.
What a great definition for the Olympics.
Yeah.
A great logistical pain in the arse.
It should be their tagline.
By the way, Henry, if you were a professional athlete, I know you're quite sporty. What would be your sport?
Interesting one. I frequently fantasize about, and this is the wrong season, this games round, but actually skiing.
Yeah.
Of various varieties. I think
we're talking
quite
about Summer Olympic Games.
No, I know. That's why I made the qualification. But I think that it's a sexy sport, an exciting sport. I think you look very cool while you're doing it.
Can you specify why it's sexy? I've been skiing quite a lot, but I never felt it.
Well, sexy in the sense that I think it's quite glamorous, both in terms of the lifestyle associated with it, but also it's very cool. I like the fact that when it's happening in France, there's always people ringing cowbells, which creates a Doppler effect as the camera goes past them.
Yeah.
Do you know what I'm talking about?
I do. I
would like to hear that as I went past. I'd like to do the big jump, because why not? Let's be honest. I think it's remarkable that humans do that.
Terrifying, isn't it?
Yeah.
I like that as well. Marcus, I feel that you're wanting to be asked what you'd do.
I guess I would go for running, or I would go for...
You are a runner, though, Marcus.
I do.
You're a competitive runner.
That's so boring. I'd like to do something different. Like, I don't know, maybe javelin.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
I think that would be good. Never tried. Actually, have tried. Didn't work out well, but...
Okay,
yeah.
Okay.
Let's not open that kind of worms here. I don't think it's quite rude.
No, indeed.
Rob, your sport.
Oh, snooker.
Yeah. Shall we move on?
Well...
1st of August, China celebrates Army Day. Celebrations take place across the People's Republic of China to mark the anniversary of the founding of the People's Liberation Army. It was founded in 1927. The PLA has over 2.2 million active personnel, which this particular press announcement claims makes it the largest army and the largest employer in the world. Now, I did some investigation about this. It is the largest standing army in the world in terms of active personnel. However, the US Department of Defense is listed as the largest employer in the world with 3.2 million employees, but they count everyone on the payroll.
God, I
even
feel
the
safe
cities.
Just hearing about
that's
it.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
I'm wondering,
like when I hear about the People's Liberation Army, I feel so liberated.
Yeah.
I feel so free. I feel really good.
You think I'm a person?
Yeah. That's
they
great.
Must liberate me.
Henry, how do you think that day is going to be celebrated in Chinese households?
I have no idea. I can tell you the soldiers themselves get half a day off, generous. And
half a day off? What's the point in that?
half a day off.
Sorry, even the holidays are done in shifts.
Half the day off and parades, concerts and galas held across China.
Gala?
Yeah.
What is this, the 1950s?
And they show off their new guns too, apparently. Something to look forward to for everyone. Do you want to hear about the other big employers, guys?
Yep.
Walmart comes third with 2.1 million. McDonald's after that.
Of course.
With 1.9 million. Any guess for number five in the chart?
I'd like to say Russian Army.
No.
That's a really good one. I literally don't know.
This is good trivia. It's the NHS.
Is it really?
It's the NHS with 1.7 million employees. That's quite remarkable.
That's something to be rather proud of, I think.
Yeah, I think so.
Good news.
And finally, I think this is really interesting. You know, Rob will know that I've got a bit of a fascination with the Vatican.
Yeah.
So this is a really interesting story. So basically, the former American journalist and communications advisor for the Vatican, he's called Greg Burke. He used to work for Time magazine and Fox News. So he's being...
Fox News. Talking of the Vatican. Okay.
All the latest updates on frogs. He's being moved sideways in the administration to become the new director of the Holy See press office. Now, from what I can gather about kind of Catholic institutional organisation, this is more like being the press officer for a country than it is for the Pope in person.
Okay.
So the Holy See is kind of the administrative
body,
precisely for the Vatican City, and he's going to become the press officer for them. Now, Greg Buck, he's a really interesting guy because he's the man who put the Pope on Twitter, and he's credited with the popularity of Pope Francis and the Francis effect, where basically Pope Francis Francis has been viewed as rejuvenating the image of the papacy. And he's basically responsible for it. I think it's a really interesting
job.
That's
a really fascinating job. What else do you expect him to do then? He's got the Pope on Twitter. What next?
He got the Pope on Twitter. He'll be working alongside a colleague called Paloma Garcia Ovejero. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. Mm. Obviously important to have a Spanish-speaking colleague in that partnership, what with so many Catholics being Hispanic.
I think that's really nice. That's a story for Monocle magazine.
I think
that's really good.
We get over
there. Day in the life of what does he get up to?
Yeah, and he tweets the Pope's tweets.
Have we reached the end of the wisdom?
I've said all I need to say.
Well, Henry, thank you very much indeed for dropping by. Marcus has got something burning.
I was just going to say that was great having you here. Thank you very much, Henry.
It was great having you here, Marcus. You're the guest.
Stop it. What about our actual guests? Henry Rees Sheridan, fantastic as ever. Thank you very much. We begin today's show by looking at New Zealand, a nation whose natural beauty has long been an asset for attracting tourism and investment. New Zealand has been in the headlines this week, though, because it's looking to protect its natural wildlife further in order to save some 25 million native birds that are killed by pests every year. Non-native species, such as rats and possums, cost the country around $3.3 billion a year to control.
Here to tell us more about the country's natural habitat is Sir Lockwood Smith, High Commissioner of New Zealand to the United Kingdom. Welcome to the Monocle Weekly, Sir Lockwood. First of all, how unified is New Zealand when it comes to this mission of getting rid of all rats and other animals that don't really belong to New Zealand?
I think there's no question about being unified in that objective, because New Zealand has such unique fauna, if you like, and flora too. I mean, trees are also damaged by possums, for example. Our puriri trees are so beautiful, and possums can really devastate them. And so there's absolutely unanimity in the need to deal with this problem. Where there perhaps is some controversy is over the most appropriate methodology, you know, the best way to do it. That's where you get some differences of opinion.
Now, possum bashing is a tough thing to do, right? It's a tough media battle to win. I feel like I'm breaking the heart of every Dame Edna Everage fan as I speak. Clearly, these two things are further apart. So possums aren't indigenous to New Zealand.
No, and it's one of the fascinating things.
How did they get there?
I guess early settlers brought them to New Zealand because it's one of the challenges. You see, you have, in some countries, you've got animals or creatures that are really lovely in that country and they don't cause a problem. You take them to a different environment and suddenly they cause a major problem. And that's what we have in New Zealand. You know, none of those sorts of cats, possums, stoats, weasels, these sort of things weren't indigenous to New Zealand. And so you bring them to New Zealand. We've got a lot of flightless birds and birds that tend to nest in really accessible places. And immediately our native fauna is at risk.
So what on earth does it take then to get rid of every single rat, possum and feral cat in New Zealand?
Well, the government has announced, you know, the objective of trying to achieve it, I think, as you said, by 2050, and it's going to spend millions of dollars. But rather than just the government spending millions of dollars on it, they're trying to set up a structure that will get private input into it too, because I think that way when you get a wider cross-section of people involved in it, not just the government, you get greater buy-in, you know, you get greater commitment to achieving the outcome. Because, you know, it's not only protecting the native birds in New Zealand, also, of course, some of these things like possums are a TB vector. And, of course, in our New Zealand, agriculture is a hugely important part of our economy. And we have most of New Zealand is TB-free. But we've got to try and make sure we get all of New Zealand TB-free, and you can't do that unless you deal with vectors.
Now, when we think of most countries, actually, we think of natural beauty tempered by man's kind of messing with it. I mean, when we think of the English countryside, I mean, that's a fake countryside. It's basically farmland is what we think of when we think of kind of beautiful, rolling English countryside. But in New Zealand, this is unabashed, this is unchanged by man, right? I mean, you've got a very different kind of kettle of fish to be dealing with.
It is the big difference. You're absolutely right. In England and the United Kingdom, you feel that people have lived in this place for many years.
Yeah.
It bears all the, you know, all the fingerprints and footprints of humanity over many years. New Zealand is different, of course, because it was colonized by people only, you know, going back a few hundred years by the Maori people, and of course by European people we became a colony in 1840. My own family arrived in New Zealand in 1862. So it's fairly, you know, all fairly recent. And you're so right. You know, I've ridden my bicycle all over New Zealand, from not to the very top, but certainly the very bottom, over most of the mountain passes and through great bushlands and over the mountains in the South Island. And it's one of the remarkable things about New Zealand is not just that there's still so many areas that are still untrammeled by human presence. It changes every couple of miles, as you say here, the scenery just changes. It's incredible. And on a bicycle, you really get to feel it.
There's plenty
it.
To protect, right? I mean, that's presumably part of your education process and your battle, if we can put it in those terms, with this conversation we're having today, is part of that. That look at all this stuff that hasn't been touched. Let's kind of keep it that way as much as we can.
And much of it will never be touched anyhow, because New Zealand is so rugged in parts. You get down into Fiordland and you know the Southern Alps. It's just untouchable anyhow. And New Zealand, a large hunk of New Zealand is locked up actually in reserves. You know,
yeah.
It's quite remarkable. I wouldn't like to put an exact figure on it in case I have it wrong, but it's a significant hunk of our land area is actually locked up in forest and bush.
It's obviously great times for tourism to New Zealand. I'm just wondering, there is always such a focus to the amazing landscape and nature you have in New Zealand. Has there been any discussions on maybe steering the tourism sector a bit so there would be other things in focus as well when it comes to marketing the country internationally?
Oh, yeah, indeed. It's not just the beautiful scenery and natural environment of New Zealand. I used to be tourism minister for New Zealand back in the late 90s. I was Minister of Tourism. I actually put in place the 100% pure tourism brand that New Zealand has. That's lasted now 17 years and still winning prizes. And it was never meant to be just about scenery. But what 100% pure meant to me was the best. And New Zealand is a remarkably innovative little place. I mean, if you want to taste some of the best wines in the world, go to New Zealand. You know, New Zealand Chardonnays and Pinot Noirs are winning global trophies. And here in the UK, in fact, New Zealand wine commands the highest average price of any country's wines in this country, higher than France, higher than Australia, the highest average price of any country here in the UK. So if you love wine, there are wonderful wine tours in New Zealand. There's all sorts of, if you like high-tech yachting, you know, around the Hauraki Gulf in New Zealand, and there's just, you know, yachting is huge there. And so many parts of New Zealand. If you love adventure, there's all sorts of adventure tourism in New Zealand. So it's not just those who love scenery, spectacular though that might be. One of the lovely things about New Zealand is in a compact place, there's so many different things you can do.
Let's get extracurricular here, Lockwood, if you don't mind me doing that. Because I've got it on pretty good authority that your hobbies, I don't know how you pack this in, because I would have thought being the High Commissioner of New Zealand is quite a busy job. Bit of opera singing on the side?
Once upon a time.
No. It says here, I have a bit. You were up singing at New Zealand House just last night.
Well, no, there's a New Zealand tradition.
Radio's not a good medium on which to blush, but I'd like to inform our listeners that the man hides his light under a bushel.
A Maori tradition in New Zealand that when people speak, what they say is, what in Maori they call a waiata, a song is sung after a person has spoken. And so we had a New Zealander leaving London next week, and so I sang the traditional Maori farewell. In English, it's called Now Is the Hour. In Maori, Poataro. It's a beautiful, beautiful song.
I like that.
And so it comes with
subtitles both ways as well. Right?
And I sang it in Maori. But it's just a tradition in New Zealand.
For you to do it yourself. This is just something you take on as another part of your role, is it?
I guess it's a tradition that catches on more and more. Maori culture is sort of permeating more of New Zealand's national cultural behaviour increasingly. You know, as you'll be aware, our All Blacks, before they play an international rugby match, perform a haka.
The Icelandic football teams have seen that. It seems to have seen that as well, right? And there's a lot of that sort of spreading out across sport, isn't it, as well?
So, you know, it's another unique thing about New Zealand. Māori culture, of course, is only found in New Zealand. And it is quite unique. The harmonies that Māori people sing with are quite fascinating. And we... and their movement, their Māori haka and dance is quite unique and has very special rhythms. And so that's another real attraction going to New Zealand. You've got many, you know, Rotorua, for example, many cultural groups perform there all the time.
Perfect.
I find it interesting that just some moments ago you said that New Zealand is a very innovative country, and I'm from Finland myself, and I'm gradually getting criticism for always going on about Finland as well. I'm just wondering... for Finland and New Zealand, they both think that they're quite innovative. Do you think there is something about a small nation that is somewhere on the outskirts that forces you to come up with different kind of ideas and different ways of thinking?
Absolutely. In fact, in New Zealand, we've formed a group globally of what we call the small, innovative, smart states. And in fact, I think often some of these smaller, more, you know, far-flung places are quite heavily involved in global innovation. New Zealand's led the world in modern farming practice, agricultural research and agricultural techniques. Finland's led the world in so many high-tech developments. And of course, in high-tech yachting developments, New Zealand's led the world in the last America's Cup, I guess, the most high-tech yachting event in the world. I think both yachts were running New Zealand technology. Certainly the American yacht Oracle was built in my old constituency in New Zealand. So, you know, we tend to have a far greater impact on global innovation than our small size might suggest. And I think it's the fact that we are small and we have to be smart that helps back that. And Finland, I agree, absolutely, is another place like us.
Well, Sir Alexander Lockwood-Smith, next time you come in, thank you very much for today's today's kind of education in how to sort of rid the country of things you don't want, and talking a very good game. But next time we want wine and song, don't we, Marcus?
Really? Absolutely.
That's one of the tenets of doing this show as well. But you are always welcome to come on the show. Sir Alexander Lockwood-Smith is the High Commissioner of New Zealand to the United Kingdom. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you. Thank you both.
Time for some music now. We've just been hearing all about New Zealand, so let's hear from one of its musical exports. This is the ever-capable Lady Hawk with a love song from her latest album, Wild Things, which came out last month.
That was New Zealand's Lady Hawk with a love song. You're listening to The Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24.
Meet the Writers is the show in which we have a chance to get intimate with some exciting authors. Airing at 1500 every Saturday and available as a podcast thereafter, it's an in-depth discussion about the life and work of a different writer every week. With me, Georgina Godwin, on Monocle 24.
You're listening to The Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Marco Sippi, and Robert Bound. Henry Elliott is a literary consultant, writer, and walker. Along with fellow city lover Matt Lloyd Rose, Henry edits Curiosity, an alternative A to Z of London. And it's also the banner under which Henry and Matt organise events that bring the city to life in unusual ways.
The duo's work has now been compiled into a book, Curiosity in Pursuit of London. The book collects the angles less explored when looking for what makes London tick. And it also features top writerly talent such as Will Self and Ian Sinclair, with a roster of illustrators to match. And Henry Elliott joins us on the line now. Henry, welcome to the programme. And first of all, congratulations on a weird and wonderful book. And I mean that in the best possible sense. Diving into the pages of Curiosity, you have made it quite Will skillful and quite strange book to inhabit in a very good way. Was that the way you wanted to set it out, to sort of be almost wandering a crazy London street?
You've hit the nail on the head, exactly. What we were hoping is for the book itself to feel a bit like London in the way that it's rich and unexpected and full of variety, and so that you can explore it as you might a city and come across unexpected pages and unexpected sections, or turn straight to the well-known thoroughfares that you might expect in a book about London.
What kind of research has it taken? I'm just wondering, for example, one of my favourite chapters in the book include Eros, which is dating and mating and the erogenous zones of London.
Yes, so exactly. So there's 26 chapters in
That's
Curiosity.
A fun one to research, though, isn't it? I could have helped you out with that. I don't know why.
Rob's a pro.
I always hear about these things too late, you know? It's fine.
So we had to have a chapter on sex because it's obviously an important part of life in London. And so the research for that chapter, the research for the whole book actually was a real mixture of, came from a real mixture of sources. And, a lot of book research and internet research, really. We didn't field test any of the odder pastimes that we describe in Eros. But we'd love to hear from anyone who does.
And it does, as you said, you wanted it to kind of feel like wandering down a London street and have all the stratum and all the strangeness therein, I suppose. And you've obviously, you've started off with a city that is, I guess, your hometown as well, Henry.
Yes,
can
right.
you roll this out to other places? Because you've sort of said, this is the only city you could do this in. This is the most interesting city in the world. You might be right, but you might be doing yourself out of some good business.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, well, we certainly haven't written off the idea of doing it for another city. The funny thing that we've kind of come to realise, having written the book, is that in a strange way, this book isn't really about London. It's about living in a city. And we've used London as an illustration for all our sections, because it's so rich and there's an illustration for everything. And so if we were to do it for another city, I think we could do it, but we'd need to rethink the whole structure, because otherwise I think it could end up just being a rerun of what we've done here with different examples slotted in. But I think that would be a really interesting challenge, to take a city like New York, for instance, or Paris or Tokyo, and think, well, what is the format that would really feel appropriate for this city, and then take it from there. The book is structured around an A to Z. There's 26 chapters alphabetically titled. And that felt like a really obvious and appropriate structure for this book, partly because of the London A to Z, Phyllis Pearsall's groundbreaking map. But also our other inspiration in that was the man of letters, Samuel Johnson, who created Johnson's famous dictionary. And he has this great image of himself at the top of his house in Gough Square plodding through the alphabet from A to Z. And we liked that idea of it seeming like a comprehensive structure to fit stuff in, and yet one having to be very selective with what one puts into the chapters.
I guess putting together this kind of a book is a great chance to process all the information you have gathered of London, all those random, sometimes unnecessary facts. What are some of the favourite dimensions London has to you?
One of the purposes of this book is to help people who know London well reimagine it in other ways. And that's been one of the big pleasures of compiling it and writing it, has been that we've kind of forced ourselves into unusual ways of thinking about the city. So a really interesting way of slicing it was in the chapter Times, and that was thinking about time in the city and all the different ways that time features in London. The chapter is called Times as a reference to the Times of London, and of course newspapers are kind of commenting on current affairs, the Times at the moment. But then there's also lots of other odd things about time in London. For instance, there's in the Greenwich Observatory, there's an asteroid which hit the... Now, what? It's a meteorite which hit the Earth, and you can touch it when you walk into the observatory main hall. And it's older than any of the rocks on Earth, because it's been flying around space since before the rocks on Earth formed. So that gives you a really crazy view of time. And then just across the river, in Trinity Boy Wharf, in the lighthouse there, there's a piece of music playing called Long Player, which is 1,000 years long. It began on the stroke of midnight, 31st of December 1999, and it'll finish in the year 3000, and it won't repeat once in that time. And so when you drop in and listen to a bit of this piece of music, which feels like a very present tense form of art, and yet you know that this is not going to finish for hundreds and hundreds of years.
It makes you feel small, doesn't it?
It makes you feel small.
And
it
I think does. That's one of the lovely things about the book, actually, Henry, is that it makes the city seem big. I guess all travel guides, all great books about places, although they should be able to be a guide to exploration, they should also kind of necessarily make you feel small, make you feel awe and wonder, make you almost feel like a child in a city. Is that something that you've kind of, I don't know whether that's something you disagree with completely or whether it's something you've done by accident or by design, if you've done it at all with your book?
Yeah, I don't think we set out to make people feel small, but I think that sense
kind of in a nice way, in a sort of childlike way. In many ways, it kind of reminded me of like books of wonder I had when I was a boy, actually. You know, those sorts of books of facts and sort of strange little funny facts and big, huge, important facts about life on Earth were kind of given the same amount of page space. And I kind of like that, you know.
That's really interesting you say that, because I think both Matt and I really enjoyed exactly that type of book when we were small. And when we were first working out how to do this as a book, we were referencing those kind of encyclopedic children's books quite a lot. And I think that's right. We've definitely got a sense of awe and wonder about London. And that was only reinforced as we were producing this book, because there was just so much material we could have included. The hardest thing was, I mean, we overwrote it massively, and the hardest thing was striking stuff out that just didn't fit. But deciding what went in and what didn't was really, really tough.
How much did you learn when you were finalising this book?
Oh, well, I mean, a huge amount. I think, what we've tried to do is something sort of crazily ambitious, which is to present a kind of comprehensive snapshot of London, but within each section. We've been highly selective, otherwise it'd be a kind of infinite book. But to create that sort of sense of it being a comprehensive structure, we had to venture into territory that we didn't have a previous knowledge of. And so we had to learn a lot to write this book. Yeah, I suppose some of the sort of kookier aspects of Eros were a good example of that. One of the strengths of the book, I think, is that unlike other guidebooks about London, we try to include some of the more taboo, or maybe not taboo, but some of the more thoughtful, serious themes that are relevant to London. So things like gentrification or loneliness or homelessness, the fact of gangs in London. And we've tried to find ways of including those aspects of London in this book in ways that aren't confrontational and are still true to the sort of quirky spirit of the book. And that was one of the hardest challenges, actually, was getting that tone right, not feeling too lectury, not sort of diminishing the seriousness of those aspects, but working them into this book to present a really cohesive picture of the whole of London.
And one of the ways you've done that, I guess, is with your illustrations. And the book is rich in illustration. It's absolutely beautiful. And you've used all sorts of different people, one of whom is Stanley Donwood, I think. He's done lots of work with Radiohead on posters and album covers and all the rest of it. How did you kind of come across the illustrators? I know that you've used a couple of well-known names, as you have with writers Ian Sinclair and Will Self as well. But in terms of the illustration, is that the world in which you live, or did people kind of come knocking at your door? Because there's so much stuff in here. It's deeply rich.
Yeah, it's a really, really exciting team of artists and contributors. Yeah, it was a real a real mixture, actually. And I mean, when we were assembling the team of artists, the main thing we were looking for was styles that we liked. And we focused particularly on people who had a previous interest in mapping of some description, although that was often very loose. And then after that, it was just sort of assembling a team that felt like a variety of illustrative style, a variety of gender, a variety of experience, actually. So some of them are well-known names, like Stanley, who did the End Papers, and Chris Riddell, the Children's Laureate, has done two fantastic chapters in the book, and Stephen Appleby, the Guardian cartoonist. And then some people, who were fresh out of art school, and we just really loved their style, and we found it online and got in touch. We met a lot more people than we ended up working with, but I think we ended up with a really exciting and a team that really worked well together. And in terms of whether, no, a lot of those people we approached to work on the book and we hadn't met before, a couple we'd worked with previously on the magazine, so they were already kind of in the Curiosity family. But it was amazing, not just the artists, but the contributors and, you know, everyone else who supplied ideas and suggestions for the book. When we came to assemble the acknowledgements page at the end, we were kind of staggered at how many names are on that list. I mean, it's been a real, real joint effort, this book, with lots and lots of people spending time pulling it together.
Just finally, Henry, have you been thinking about releasing yet another book on London, and what would it be like?
Good question. We've tried to pour everything we've got into this one. So there are no plans at the moment to do another book on London. Gosh, if we were to do another one, I really don't know. I mean, this book stretches from the moment that Southern England burst through the waves as the earth was being created, right far into the future when London's wiped out and it's just a stinking, poisonous swamp. So it's quite hard to think how we'd sort of find another angle in a way. But the one thing we've definitely learnt about London is that it's endlessly rich. So, yeah, who knows? Maybe there's a whole 26 more chapters that we've omitted from this one that could come out in a sequel.
Indeed. And to paraphrase that great joke from Blackadder about Dr. Johnson's dictionary, you completely forgot contrafibularity, sir. There's a challenge for book two. It is a wonderful thing. I'm so pleased to have spoken to you on the phone, Henry. There are so many boring books about places. This is a beautiful one and well worth any investment. Henry Elliott, co-author with his mate Matt Lloyd-Rose of Curiosity in Pursuit of London. Thank you very much.
Many thanks. Pleasure.
Okay, you are listening to the music of Martin Creed, the Turner Prize winning artist whose album Thoughts Lined Up is very fine and is out now.
I'm understanding, listening.
The album's no-nonsense title is meant to convey the process of how Martin went about making it, taking simple mantras that appeared in the artist's head, some of which just wouldn't go away. It was recorded at London's Toe Rag Studios, the all-analogue recording space helmed by the producer Liam Watson. Creed is also, of course, known for his uncompromising and provocative visual artwork. His exhibition The Back Door is about to wrap up in New York City next week. Listeners can still go along. And he also has an ongoing show, What You Find, at Houseman Earth's Gallery in Somerset. That's on until September. A lot of stuff going on, Martin Creed. Welcome to the programme. And first of all, we played you in with a track called Understanding from that wonderful new record. It's a nice way of making a thing, as you say. The many tracks on that LP are kind of straightforward, straight-thinking kind of mantras. How did you approach the writing of that? Did they just pluck out of the ether and you grab them, or do you have to stay up all night scribbling? How does it work?
It's probably a mixture of both of those in other ways as well. But definitely I was trying to do keep it simple and be as direct as possible.
Yeah.
From to go as quickly as possible from the initial idea, if it was like a little tune or a few words that I was thinking about, to try and get quickly from that to some kind of song, rather than trying to work on it too much, which I feel like I have a tendency to overwork things. So I was literally trying to line up everything I had, you know, whether it's from notebooks or voice memos, like audio notes, and line them all up and basically see what they sounded like. And that's how most of the songs were put together.
Because there is a very attractive thing there about the immediacy of stuff, getting stuff down on tape or getting the song down before it turns into something else, capturing that thing, that amorphous thing before it, you know, turns into some sort of prog rock album is what could have happened. Putting the bells and whistles on it. How do you keep that process under control, I wonder?
Well, that is the one of the reasons I did it on tape, because I find with computers that I use computers a lot, but I always have multiple versions of everything, and you know, and there's so many. I mean, I think you could. I feel that you can. I'm sure you can work with computers if you're more. If you're very disciplined,
This tape just gives you a very binary choice, right?
You just have to do it on a, you know, in a line like that. Although, of course, you can cut the tape up, but that's a lot more difficult than, you know, cutting things up digitally. I feel like having constraints usually helps, you know, a little. And so working live on tape, and I did it with the band all, and we were all in the same room.
Just kind of cut live.
And there was no real separation either. That's another thing that I didn't want to do.
Sight lines and stuff.
Right? I didn't want to have the drummer in a box and the singers in another box. And so we were all in the room, and we just had mics around the room without trying to...
It's got a very nice live feel, that record as well, and it kind of sounds like that. You don't get much of that. And then we said in the introduction, didn't you, that you did that at Liam Watson's Toe Rag Studios.
Well, it was actually recorded in Brixton in a different studio, and then it was mixed at Toe Rag, yeah.
What's the asset? And it seems like there is a febrile. There's a nice intense feel to that record. Is that something that was happening in the studio at the time? Is that the day that it was captured, or is that some studio mastery put on?
The bonhomie.
Is that all real?
I wanted to work with all the people in the room, so we all had to get along together.
Right.
You know,
helps.
it wasn't, I think we got on reasonably well, but however we got on, I think that probably comes through in the final result. But you know, if you work in a more divided up way, you know, and have some, you know, phone someone up and get someone to work on something, you know, remotely over there, and then someone else works on something over there, and then you can kind of piece it together maybe in a program, you know, that then the people don't really have to get on. You know,
I think it helps, though. So, you don't want to be like... I went to Abbey Road Studios this week, and they showed me... It was Studio 3, where Pink Floyd did Dark Side of the Moon, and the band weren't getting on very well, and each person marched in with their part, you know, the bass line, lead guitar, the vocal, the drum track, and it's kind of weird. It's nice to to go back to basics with these things, right, and actually like the people you're making the record.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I wanted to ask about the live... Martin Creed Live as well, your live proposition. People love going to see you. I know you played Glastonbury this year. I've been to see you in Miami at the art fair, actually.
Oh yeah,
and that was a good raucous time.
Oh, yeah.
What does that feel like? Does that feel, because people will kill me for not asking you this question about the idea of art as kind of letting go. What is more cathartic, to get up on stage and rock out or folk out, whatever the song might be, Martin, or to make the visual art?
It's very, when you're doing it, yeah, because if I put a painting on the wall, then I go away and I'm not there, you know,
to steward it.
I'm not there with it.
People
aren't looking at me, they're looking at the painting. So, but if I'm doing a gig and I'm singing songs, then people might be looking at me, although they might not, because they're free to look where they like. But that's scary.
You're the focal point in a different way, aren't you?
If people don't like it, if people don't like a painting, you're not necessarily there to hear the abuse, you know. But if they don't like you when you're playing, you might they might not throw something at you, but you might feel it in another way, you know. And that's very scary. But I think that I find that working like that exciting because you can feel, you know, directly. You're with people and you can feel the thing. Whereas if you're working in a room making something and then you put that in a gallery, then there's kind of, everything's a bit separated. And yeah. I feel that I need to do live shows to work on things and to stop myself just going off in my own bubble, you know, and kind of getting in my own kind of deluded world where that I feel like I'm in danger.
Yeah, but we like the stuff that comes out of it. You see, that's the problem. when you're successful artists, you have to, people going, well, we want that. We like that. Come on, right. We want that. But it's not the same when you're on the other end of it, right? You're like, I've got to make this stuff. Give me a break.
Well, I don't know. Yeah. I don't know how I'll make it, if I do make it. But
and let's talk about that. You said that sometimes it's easier to have a bit of confinement, or, you know, you have to, whether it's a deadline or a title for something, you work within the constructs and you make a 3-minute song, and that's the kind of thought that was in your head, and that was the mantra, that was the line that you were exploring, and bang, and there it is. Yeah. Can you work it in visual art in that way, in the sense of giving yourself almost a title for a show or a title of a work and backwards engineering it? Do you know what I mean? Or do they appear very much as physical things and then you attach a name to them, I wonder?
I think that it's helpful to have a starting point, and to have constraints, and I think that goes for everything really, because I don't know what I want, or rather I want everything, you know. I want to eat all the cakes on the menu, you know, but then I can't do that because I feel sick, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
So then, you know, maybe I ask the advice of the waiter,
which is the best. Or narrow it down to 3 cakes.
Yeah,
and
or ask if I could have a little bit of each of them.
Yeah,
you know,
I think that is literally what we call having your cake and eating it. Aren't these artists? They want it. They want it all. Come on.
But I feel like, you know, the constraints that, you know, I mean, one constraint would be if just someone said, you know, if you got, you know, if someone kind of kidnapped you and put you in a room and said, look, you're not gonna, you know, I'm not gonna let you out unless you, you know, write a piece of music for piano that's 5 minutes long, you know, and you know, or something like that.
That's
you know,
that's what more people need. That.
But, you know, and
it's a strange kind of hostage situation. We're going live to an artist in a room here.
And I think that is, to a certain extent, what happens when you're commissioned to do something. You know, in a way, it's like that. You're not a hostage, but if someone's paying you and you want the money because it helps you to live, then effectively you are a hostage. And I feel like that, I think, a lot.
But that's what we're saying. Is that quite a good thing as well, though? Because you know that you've got to write a 5-minute piece of music. You know that it's got to be written on the piano, or you're not going to hear the...
Because it makes your... it makes your life simple, and you've got a goal, you know, and you're going to escape if you write the piece. And... But I think but other constraints I think are maybe less obvious, and it's because it's kind of internal. It might be like that you feel sick, you know, like with the cake thing. It might be that if you do something, you're going to feel sick, so you're always within your own. I mean, you're in the limitations of your own body, and with me, if I'm singing or whatever, then it's my voice or whatever it is my little constraints are, you know, and
But constraints are, I mentioned What You Find, which is your show at Hauser & Wirth down in Somerset. And that's got all sorts of stuff in it, hasn't it? There's not very little. I mean, there's a constraints of the place that it's in. But other than that, it's a big, wide range of all sorts of different media and all sorts of different stuff.
Yeah.
Is that you kind of forging into the future with your working practice, I wonder, to try to incorporate more of the stuff? It seems like a solar system of stuff floating around. You're kind of grabbing bits
Is that how it feels? Yeah. Well, I was definitely trying to throw it all in there to see, and to throw it at the wall to see what sticks. And I really don't know what sticks, you know. And I think I was, I think in that exhibition or leading up to that, I was quite frustrated in a way. A lot of that work isn't. I wasn't sure about it. I was consciously trying to say to myself, all right, I really will try to get all this stuff there and see what it's like, you know, and as much of it as possible, but feeling frustrated with myself that I don't know what it is really that I want to do. And I don't know what I have done either, you know. And if I look at, there's some things that I've done that sometimes I might see or hear them, and I think, oh yeah, I like that. But I don't. But often it's by that point, by the time you can enjoy something, it's so far distant in the past, you can't even remember really. It's not that helpful in terms of doing something
but
now.
Yeah, but that's art that stands the test of time. Because I tend to think lots of your work is kind of single-minded in its clarity, actually. Quite the opposite. You might not think it is. But I think it's kind of like, wow, that's one amazingly good idea executed perfectly. That's how it seems, Yeah, actually.
It's
kind of good. It's kind of like a laser beam. You know, oh wow, that's the best thing I've seen. That's absolutely incredible. How'd you come up with that? And I suppose there's all this backstory of trying to squeeze all the cake mixture into the piping tube. Wanting to eat all the cakes in the world analogy.
it makes me happy that you say that. But the I think it's probably if it's anything like that, it's to do with. The fact, I think, that I just don't know, that I can't, that I'm simple, and I am, you know, trying to keep things simple so that I can understand them, and so sometimes things might end up being quite, might be single-minded.
Yeah.
But, or simple-minded, or something like that.
Well, that's a big difference between those. That is a single-minded or simple-minded discuss, and then a 400-page book comes out on the subject. I want to just go back to the music before we finish, Martin, because that seems very. I don't know whether simple-minded or single-minded. You can tell me. But you know, in the sense that there's lots of tracks on that record, but they are 3 minutes. They're short. They're snappy. They're boom. They're one thing done until that thing's finished.
Yeah.
Is that very satisfying at the end of that, cutting that record? That record exists as a CD, as an LP, as a thing. Is that a very satisfying thing to land in your lap, that it is a done thing?
I'm excited about those songs, but to me, some of them are a bit in progress, even now. And so when I did it as well, I was trying to, because I feel like that's why I've sometimes overworked things, is that I want to finish it and make it a perfect thing. And so I was trying to let go of some of those things when they weren't actually finished. So just line it all up and see what it's like. Although now I think some of those songs are finished, but some of them aren't.
Do you finish them on stage when you play? Is that a way of kind of finishing that thought?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think so. And although a lot of them I had been working on live before I did the recording, I think that is the only way really to test things out. Because I think if something bears repetition, you know, if you can bear to sing it and you feel all right, then it's probably all right, you know. But I knew, but the only way to do that is to try.
To try and try and get it. But I think it must be a nice thing to have that thing. It's done. It's dusted. You can fine-tune it.
It's exciting.
Fine-tune it when you're doing it live, maybe in a strange kind of way. Maybe there's two tracks on a record that you don't quite like. You kind of go, I can finish that off in front of some people. You know, it's a nice option to have. Right?
It's definitely something to. It's like a handle, something to hang on to. You know, while I'm hanging off the cliff.
In that case, Martin Creed, We'll stop it there. There are a million things we could have asked you. Congratulations on a fantastic LP, on those two shows that are finishing up, one in New York, one in Somerset until September. Plenty of time to see that one. What you find, it is a universe of wonderful things. Thank you very much indeed. A man you should definitely let into your art gallery, definitely let onto your stage, but let nowhere near your cake shop. It's Martin Cree. Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot.
Well, there we have it, Marcus. I think a classic. We don't do this often enough, the two of us man the Monocle Weekly desk.
It's always very enjoyable doing it this way.
Oof.
Well, the amount of flattering today, like in the previous 60 minutes,
like
has been quite astonishing.
Lathered in radio butter and put into the oven, gas mark 6. It's a bit too hot, isn't it? But I don't mind burning. What does the rest of your Sunday hold in store, Marcus Hippie?
I guess I'm going to head back home. I'm going to make some food and close my eyes and just recall all the events that happened in Stavanger again.
Oh man, it makes me blush slightly. Do you know what? There's only one thing for us left to do. Thank our friends behind the glass there. Today's show was produced by Tom Hall.
And researched by Barclay Bram. And our studio manager was Toby Hammond.
So that's it. Same time, same place next week for the Monocle Weekly. Who knows who'll be presenting it? It's a crazy carousel of presenters. But for the time being, from me, Robert Bounds.
And me, Marcus Hippie.
Thanks for tuning in.